The last matter on the court's docket is the Selah matter. Ms. Costell, Mr. Bradley, Ms. Greenberg.
Yes. Okay. Morning.
Ms. Ross. Morning.
Carolyn Costell on behalf of Ms. Selah, and I'm joined at council table by Mr. Greenberg, who is also on the brief.
Okay. Are you guys splitting your time, or are you?
I think at this point I'm probably doing both.
Okay.
Yes.
Then how much time would you like to reserve?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay.
If it's still available after, you know. So there's a little bit of suspense there.
Yeah, well, it's the fun of it, the unpredictability.
Exactly.
Whenever you're ready.
All right, thank you. This appeal on behalf of Ms. Selah is only an appeal of spousal support. There are a number of issues to say. We only appeal of spousal support, and then we are asking this court to reverse with direction to the circuit court to enter a decree that's in accordance with the party's contract. There are a number of errors, but they all stem from one fundamental error that the trial court judge made, and that is that these parties entered into an agreement. This agreement specified spousal support and how it would be modified in perpetuity, the parameters for that. The trial court then found it was a contract, found it was a contract at the motion to strike stage, and then later, even in the final ruling, found again that it was a contract, but then it entered an award that was not in accordance with the contract, specifically in violation of Code Section 20-109C. The court then compounded this error by holding that the contract was no longer operative and was dissolved at the time of the final divorce decree. The error sort of starts and ends with 20-109C, which is the code section that says in suits for divorce, annulment, separate maintenance, if a stipulation or contract is entered into by the parties, and specifically by the party who's seeking relief, and that such contract is submitted before the entry of the final decree of divorce, no order or decree directing the payment of support and maintenance for the spouse, suit money, counsel fee, or establishing or imposing any other condition or consideration, monetary or non-monetary, shall be entered into except in accordance with that stipulation or contract. And the case law certainly that follows upon that reiterates that. The Selahs were separated in February of 2012. In 2013, Ms. Selah filed a petition for separate maintenance. Before that ever came to any court hearing, the parties entered into mediation with their lawyers and a retired judge from the McCammon Group and came up with a contract that resolved support as well as a number of property issues.
What was the purpose of addressing the separate maintenance status of the parties, was it not?
It was.
No,
it definitely was a contract
there was
for
separate. No evidence was there that parties entered this contract for the purpose of addressing their status as divorced individuals.
Well, there is. I mean, there are a couple of things that they did do in this contract.
I'm not talking about the content of the contract, because you could argue that all of the issues that one would normally have to address as a trial court in a divorce setting are addressed in a separate maintenance. But I'm not sure that answers the question.
So are you saying that the parties at that time entered into it only, that their intent was only?
I don't know. I'm asking the parties. It would seem as though one could deduce from at least its not only the title of the contract, but the circumstance under which it was entered, that the contract was only intended to govern the parties' positions in a separate maintenance posture. There are other reasons I go there, one of which is legal. It is a contract, and it seems to me it is open to the interpretation that must be given to contracts, including the intent of the parties, because in this case, the parties are in dispute as to what the intent was.
Well, I think the contract is pretty clear and unambiguous. I'm not sure we go outside of it to pull evidence. But what I would say is at the trial...
You don't have to go outside. You can take the four corners.
The four corners.
The agreement, and that's what I'm looking at.
Right.
Your position is it was intended to govern the parties in divorce.
The position was it was intended to govern the parties in separate maintenance. It would be intended to govern the parties in divorce. It was the spousal support.
How do you deal with, because this is really the bottom line question, how do you deal with Virginia law that distinguishes between separate maintenance, suits for separate maintenance, and suits for divorce? They are seen as separate remedies, if you will, to use one of the terms that...
Well, it's true, and I think that that is partly where things got confused. But I think in this situation, the terms of the contract themselves, first of all, the contract also includes a number of property-related provisions. I mean, it was a partial property settlement agreement. It completely goes through the details of how the house is going to be appraised and a buyout would be arranged, and that that house was then exempt from future equitable distribution. So you certainly see that within the four corners of the document. The spousal support provision itself does not contain any provisions for termination or that it's pending or could be modified upon a divorce. It contains very specific terms for how it will be modified, that it will be looked at annually, but that any modification will be based on a change in circumstances. It sets its own terms for modification. And it even puts in a somewhat unusual term, in that it says that one factor that will not be considered a term for modification will be if the wife is earning $2,500 or less a month.
How do you address the Scott versus Scott?
Scott versus Scott
says that separate maintenance provisions are only operative and effective while the parties are married.
Yes, but this, I would say the contract itself, I would say two things.
Well, you're not answering the question.
But how does Scott do it?
That's the whole thing in Scott, that separate maintenance provisions, I agree, it says by court order. I'm not sure why that should be the distinguishing factor, because Virginia sees a distinction between separate maintenance and divorce, and you can make some arguments that are purely outside the law as to why that should be. All right, they only apply while the parties are married. And you're asking that their provisions that are denominated for separate maintenance apply post-divorce.
Well, I would say the phrase separate maintenance is only in the title. And I would say that throughout the document, it's used the word spousal support, I mean, throughout. And I would say that the big thing about Scott, though, is Scott was a court order, and I think 20-109C has to govern. I think this was a contract in a suit for separate maintenance. It's a contract for divorce. I think it's a contract that contains a term that exists in perpetuity, that the modification of this document of support needs to be within what this document has said.
Are you suggesting that we should be dismissive of the title?
No, I think, as I said, I think it absolutely resolved the separate maintenance case. I absolutely think that this contract was a contract that the judge in the separate maintenance case couldn't go above and beyond. But because not only did the court find that it's a contract, and the court has no authority unless it's within the parameters of the contract to dissolve a contract between the parties. I think that's the Newman case.
But isn't that unless one party objects, and in this case?
No, it says even if a party objects. I believe the phrase from Newman is very specifically, I will pull the exact quote, I believe that the phrase is that absent equitable grounds warranting rescission, a contract cannot be judicially modified or terminated at the unilateral request of a contract party unless the agreement expressly authorizes such relief. The same is true for a consent decree. That is the quote from Newman. And I think that the issue...
By the way, I took that objection implicitly, suggesting that it was not a contract that was envisioned under the code section that we began with, that says when a contract is a suit for divorce or separate maintenance, even that.
Well, I think it says and. It says and. Divorce, annulment, not sure how you get one in annulment, but and separate maintenance. Yes.
Okay. I'm not sure that the objection wasn't based on the fact that this party, opposing party, does not believe it was intended to govern the relationship post-divorce.
But then the contract could have said it could have said that.
Let me get through my non-legal question. It seems at least arguable that how parties resolve their differences for support, equitable distribution, etc., could differ visibly and importantly whether they're going to live separate and apart or whether they're going to dissolve all their legal obligations under our marital laws. And it suggests to me that those contracts could be vastly different. Maybe this one isn't.
Wait, I'm not sure this one is. I think also at the hearing and in the judge's findings, she also found that Mr. Sela intended soon after the parties separated in 2012, well before this was entered, that this was going to be a permanent separation.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal.
I'm into my rebuttal. I will step back.
Mr. Rawls?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Meredith Rawls for the appellee, Mr. William Sela. And we are requesting that the trial court's decision be affirmed. The appellant makes 7 assignments of error, which can be essentially dealt with under 2 themes. The first is regarding the contract, and the second is regarding the trial court's findings regarding spousal support. Turning to the first 3 assignments of error, regarding the consent decree for separate maintenance, this was a contract, but we must ask, what was it a contract for? And it was a contract for separate maintenance. That is not only in the title, it is also in the first paragraph, noting that this came about as a result of Ms. Sela's petition for separate maintenance.
Well, why would it matter if it covers all the issues that one should address in the course of the divorce?
Your Honor, the appellant seems to argue that because it deals with many different issues, it somehow transforms this contract from one solely for separate maintenance into one that is envisioned to be permanent for divorce. However, such a reading would do violence to the contract as it would disregard the context in which this contract was arrived, which is stated within the 4 corners of the contract. The court must.
It seems to me the element that hasn't been addressed in the court below, probably because it wasn't raised, so I'm not sure whether I'm now really on thin ice, is what was the intent of the parties? Implicitly, what was the intent of the parties? Was it to govern their relationship post-marriage, post-divorce, or not? I think the court said it was. Implicitly, that's what it said. It can be applied post-divorce. But I don't know that...
Well, ultimately, the court changed its ruling on that, correct?
Ultimately, yeah. Ultimately, the court said, yeah, it reversed its decision. In fact, it leaves open that other question as whether the matter should have been opened. So...
Yes, Your Honor. The intent of the parties, which can be determined by the 4 corners of the contract, is that this is a contract for separate maintenance. A divorce action was not pending at the time. There's no evidence that either of them intended to at any point file for divorce, although there was no intent for reconciliation. And the court must read the contract as a whole, and that includes looking at the title and the first paragraph and recognizing that this is spousal support for separate maintenance. And if we are to say, no, the entire contract is only one that is meant to be incorporated into a divorce, would be to disregard that context that's stated within the contract.
And this has been referred to a number of times as a contract. This was a court order, wasn't it? It was entered by the judge?
Yes, it was a court order.
Regardless of whether it came through mediation or some agreement during the course of It was initiated by litigation filed by the wife. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It resulted in conclusion by court order.
That's correct. And the court would only have the jurisdiction to award items for separate maintenance, not for support post-divorce. The question has never been raised whether certain provisions of that contract would be enforceable or the certain provisions of the order would be enforceable through contempt proceedings for failure to comply. That's not before the court today, but the court did have power to award spousal support for separate maintenance, and that's what the court awarded upon the consent of the parties. And the separate maintenance, as the Scott decision makes clear, terminates as a matter of law upon divorce. For these reasons, the trial court reconsidered its own decision, which it has the right to do during the course of the litigation.
But when it reconsiders a decision that, based upon that reversal of its original path, might result in one or the other parties, if not both, wanting to present additional evidence based on a changed ruling, can you deal with the motion to reconsider and why it was not error to deny the motion to reconsider to present additional evidence based on a ruling that was changed without further notice?
Yes, Your Honor. The court has the discretion to reconsider its orders. I think the fundamental issue is that Ms. Seela failed to preserve error on this point by failing to proffer the evidence that she wished to present. As I explained in my brief, the trial court did have...
This was not an evidentiary hearing. This was the motion to reconsider. So the motion to reconsider is generally you're bringing some mistake before the court and why they should reopen it so that evidence can be presented. Why in an evidentiary, why in something that is not an evidentiary hearing is proffer necessary, particularly under Schultz v. Schultz, which I believe was perhaps authored by someone on this panel?
Ms. Seela's chief complaint is that that her evidence was excluded. And in order for this court to determine whether such an exclusion abused the court's discretion, that evidence must be placed before this court, and it was not.
How does Schultz v. Schultz apply to this?
Your Honor, I must admit I cannot speak to that. I'm not as familiar with that decision as I would like to be. However, as I explained in my brief, even if this error was preserved, the court had...
Get back to your argument that,
yes, Your Honor,
that it was defaulted. I believe there was a petition, in the petition for divorce, there was a request for a resolution of the equitable distribution of support matters.
That's correct.
That was there. That's not the problem. But I don't believe there's anything that limited the parties on the proof that would be required, or the theory, if you will, of proof that would be required. I don't think they were limited. I know that appellant relied on the contract. No, yes. And appellee,
yes,
wanted, I guess, objected to relying on the contract, but I don't know that that alone would preclude the appellee from then putting on a different theory of proof on the issues. Well, I don't understand why it would, which is different than arguing over whether a particular piece of evidence was not permitted.
Yes, Your Honor. Nothing prevented Ms. Seela, the wife, from presenting any evidence that she sought, that she deemed necessary.
She didn't put it on even when the plot was going forward with the contract theory, right? There's no evidence of any sort of that. Well, I can't say that's a little broad, but there was not full evidence on what she wanted to present.
Correct, Your Honor. And at no point during the trial did Ms. Seela attempt to present evidence and then be denied that attempt because of the court's ruling during the course of the trial.
Well, at that point, the ruling is just what she wanted.
Yeah, that's true.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why present more evidence when things are going your way? It's only when all of a sudden that's changed that you might want to present more evidence.
That's correct. I understand. However, at that point, once she desired to present more evidence, it was incumbent upon her to proffer what that evidence would be.
But isn't that what the motion to rehear was? Essentially, when the court reversed itself, Ms. Seal is now in the posture of realizing that information that she wanted before the court, she didn't have the opportunity to get it before the court.
Yes, but the motion to reconsider was too nebulous for the court to make a decision. It merely stated that she did not present certain items of evidence regarding income and expenses.
How is that too nebulous, though, if one of the issues obviously is spousal support?
Your Honor, the court would need to know what items of evidence were not presented. Otherwise, any litigant could possibly come before the court, provide a motion to reconsider, and say, well, there was something I didn't present to the court, and not tell the court what was unpresented.
Except that that presumes probably a hearing that where the adversarial process ran its course on the presentation of evidence related to the calculation of spousal support. As I understand this hearing, it was just to determine whether the order of separate maintenance provided solely for separate maintenance during the course of the pre-divorce proceedings, or whether or not it would survive the divorce as well and thus be incorporated into the final decree, or at least survive the final decree. Now, that's not evidence taking for the purpose of calculating spousal support, is it?
No, because the evidence had already been presented at trial approximately a month earlier. Again, if any litigant desires to present additional evidence for any reason to a trial court, it is incumbent upon that litigant to proffer that evidence to the trial court. To hold otherwise would open a wide floodgate for appeals to be brought to this court and then to reverse trial courts because there was something that some litigant forgot to or decided not to present to the trial court. That's why we have such a strong law of proffer in Virginia. Further, there was evidence presented sufficient to justify the trial court's holding. The trial court could have and did rightfully decide that it had heard sufficient evidence to make its ruling, and therefore no further evidence was needed. And again, without describing which witnesses, which documents, and which testimony that Ms. Seela desired to present to the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying that opportunity. Pending any further questions from the court, I will conclude my argument, and I request that the trial court's holding be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Costell?
I think the first thing I want to address is the question about this document being a contract. And I think one thing is not only did the court find it was a contract, both at the motion to strike stage and then at the final ruling stage.
But it's also a court order, correct?
It's also a court order. But however,
it was generated as a result of adversarial proceedings.
But the marital.
Is that right?
Yes. It is also a court order. The marital agreements statute 20-155 also provides ways in which parties can enter into agreements. One is that they can sign an agreement that's actually under, I guess, 20-149, but it's referenced in 20-155. But 20-155 also defines marital agreements as, and I'm going to jump around a little bit because it's a long paragraph, that married persons may enter into agreements with each other for the purpose of settling the rights and obligations of either or both of them to the same extent and with the same effect and subject to the same conditions as those who can do premarital ones, except the marital agreements become effective immediately upon their execution. It then goes on to say, if the terms of such agreement are contained in a court order endorsed by counsel or the parties, and then or recorded or transcribed by a court reporter and phoned by the parties on the record personally, the agreement is not required to be in writing and is considered to be executed. So they're actually, even before the court makes a ruling, which is the law of the case, that it's a contract, the parties both signed it, and the fact that it's a court order also makes it a marital agreement. And so then you go back to 20-109C, if the parties enter into a stipulation or agreement, the court, in a divorce case or a separate maintenance case, can't enter anything different than what they've agreed to.
But the law of Virginia is that separate maintenance does not survive divorce.
The law of, in Scott versus Scott, there was no contract in that case. There was no invocation of 20-109C.
And you changed the law that says separate maintenance is only effective while the parties are married.
But I'm not sure this contract...
That's the underlying premise for Scott, not that there was a contract or a court order.
Right, but I think in this case, it would be true if that had been a judge-ordered court order, and then you would be going and have something new, or but then you have to go.
The law doesn't change whether people work out their litigation by way of agreement that results in a court order, or whether it's decreed by judge or by jury.
But it does matter. We give incredible respect in divorce cases to the parties working out their own agreements.
But they can't work something out contrary to law and expect to have that enforced.
But I don't believe that this is contrary to law. I believe that in this particular situation, they wrote very detailed provisions in perpetuity for spousal support.
Aside from your contention that Scott is somehow distinguishable because there was not a contract or an agreement in that one, is there any other way you get around Scott?
Absolutely. These people contracted for spousal support. They contracted for, they did not contract for separate maintenance. They contracted.
Even though the order, is that's what it's titled.
The order says separate maintenance. The order also contained language about the equitable distribution of their
house. I understand that, but it's titled an order for separate maintenance, is it not?
Yes. It definitely resolves the separate maintenance case.
You're disregarding the fact that it was formulated in the context of a suit for separate maintenance. You're just...
I think it was a negotiated and mediated agreement that started there.
In the context of separate maintenance, it has to be given some weight.
But then the language, if the language was only to last until such time as the parties filed a divorce, the consent order should have contained those terms. That's what Newman stands for. That's what a lot of the cases stand for.
It's also what the law provides.
But the law defers to contracts. The law defers
to... But not when they're contrary to law. And if the law of the Commonwealth of Virginia is that separate maintenance does not survive the divorce, then there you have it.
But but does that mean that then the equal distribution of the house wouldn't survive?
Interesting part about this format is I get to ask the question.
Oh, you're right. I'm going back on the hypothetical. Now, I think that this contract, every part of this contract survives... except to the degree the court is given the ability to modify it. They're given the ability to modify support. They're given the ability to modify the insurances. They're not given the ability to ever modify the house. So I think the contract survives. And so that's what I would request that this court do.
Counsel, unfortunately, you're out of time.
I am out of time. Thank you.
We're going to come down and greet.